Judge Rebecca Dallet is the latest woman to win election in Wisconsin. She makes the Wisconsin Supreme Court the nation's highest in percentage of women justices. Dallet's win comes as a record number of women are expected to run for office this year in Wisconsin and across the nation. We're talking about the gender makeup of politics here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The chairwoman of the Dallas County Republican Party, Missy Shorey, heads up Maggie's List. That's a PAC that's dedicated to electing conservative women to office. She points that out, that in the history of America, 328 women have served in Congress.
53% of the electorate in the presidential election are women. And yet, that is the outcome of who we are choosing to represent us, regardless of party. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of perception, in terms of qualification, in terms of funding, and in terms of, most importantly, step number one, self-selection. Can you do it? And I think we're beginning to see a bit of a crack in that barrier.
Following this year in Wisconsin is Jessie Apoyan. She covers state government and politics for the Capital Times. She's also the author of the recent piece, She's Running the Campaign, Women Manage Most Wisconsin Democratic Governor Campaigns. Jessie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, let's start philosophical here. Why should we examine how women impact politics?
Well, it's a lot of what we heard in that clip that we just listened to. Women are underrepresented in politics, and they have been traditionally, despite being a prominent, portion of the population. Women are not seeing people who look like them in office. Of course, I mean, the numbers are even worse for women of color. So the reason why we study it and why we do stories like this is because I think we all agree we want to see more women in office. And something that I looked at in my most recent story is, what are women doing behind the scenes?
And what are women doing behind the scenes? Because you looked at the makeup of these campaigns, who's running the campaigns, who's doing the ground coordination. What did you find?
It was interesting and surprising. This is something new in Wisconsin this year. Seven of the nine gubernatorial campaigns in the Democratic field that have hired staff are being run by women. This is unheard of in Wisconsin. And, there's not a lot of solid empirical research on this, but this is also sort of agreed to be unprecedented in the country, too. There is a lot of research now on women running for office. There's less research on women running things behind the scenes. But there's a strong presence. It ranges from veterans to novices running these campaigns right now. But the majority of them are women who have been working behind the scenes in Wisconsin politics for the last at least 10 years, working their way up through the ranks. And this year, the timing was right.
What did you hear from the staff? What were some of the thread lines here when you spoke with them about where they drew their inspiration for these campaigns?
Certainly most of the women that I talked to said they didn't see a lot of women doing the jobs that they wanted to do as they were younger coming up. But when they did see women in leadership positions, it was incredibly important for them to watch them, to mirror them, for those women to kind of help them and lift them up. It's a lot about support and women supporting other women. There's just tons of research, none that I've conducted, but on just the tendency and the importance of women to lift each other up because of tendencies for men to interrupt or just not give credit where credit's due. So they didn't see a lot of women in leadership positions, but the ones that they did work with played a large role. There are also some of these women worked for women politicians, and that helped them too.
Did we see these campaigns managed differently in any way?
Well, we don't know that yet. Certainly, we'll see. I think, again, anecdotally, yes, some things changed for the same reasons why things are different with women in office. It's a different voice at the table. It's giving voice to another set of experiences. So while the field of candidates this year is still pretty overwhelmingly white and male, there are women bringing up issues, and a lot of younger women, for that matter, bringing up issues that maybe those male candidates wouldn't be thinking of if they had another man running their campaign.
Talking with Jessie Apoyan, she covers state government and politics for the Capital Times, and she's been looking into campaigns, who they're run by, and the surge in women managing most Wisconsin Democratic governor campaigns. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. Are you a woman who is running for office this year? What prompted you to launch a campaign? And what reservations did you have? How did you move past them to jump into the race? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Jesse, earlier this month, Judge Rebecca Dallet grabbed national headlines when she handily won a seat on the state Supreme Court, and that put Wisconsin in the spotlight as well, because that put six women and one man on the state's high court. Who ran her campaign?
It was a woman named Jessica Lovejoy. There was, of those three, the three campaigns for the state Supreme Court this year, two were run by women, both women who have experience running campaigns in Wisconsin, and one of them was successful. And that was unfortunately not a campaign I spent a lot of time delving into in this story, but definitely one that other women who are running other races brought up as sort of an inspiration to say, hey, look, this is working out pretty well for us.
You interviewed Betsy Ankeny, who works on U.S. Senator Ron Johnson's successful reelection campaign in 2016, earned her the Campaign Manager of the Year Award from the American Association of Political Consultants. What did she tell you?
Well, that was an important perspective to get, because this piece obviously focused on the Democratic women who are running campaigns here. But Betsy Ankeny ran Ron Johnson's campaign, which was sort of despite being the incumbent, sort of an underdog campaign in a lot of ways. National groups sort of left that campaign for dead. And it was very much an effort of the people who were actually in Wisconsin on the ground. A lot of credit was given to Betsy for carrying them past the finish line to the point where she won that award. But Betsy talked about not seeing this necessarily from a partisan perspective, thinking, is one party better or worse than the other in terms of putting women in leadership roles. You know, she still had a lot of the same experiences that other Democratic women that I talked to had, in terms of not a ton of women in leadership roles, but certainly ones in very prominent leadership roles who helped her make sure she was sitting in on meetings, get a foot in the door, make sure she was staying connected, staying involved. And what she said, I think that everyone would agree with, that I talked to, is women just have to work a little bit harder sometimes. They've just got a little more fire in the belly, a little more something to keep them engaged, because they know it's going to be that much tougher.
But she also said she sees no major differences between the two main political parties in encouraging women to take on leadership positions. Did you hear this viewpoint elsewhere?
You know, I didn't necessarily, and I didn't talk about it a lot with a lot of the women who are running. Of course, what we're seeing in Wisconsin right now is overwhelmingly Democratic, and that sort of jibes with what we're seeing in terms of women who are running for office. This year, the trend is to see more women running for office and more women running as Democrats. Not a lot of research on the behind-the-scenes aspect of it, but yeah, you know, I think Democrats, while they do have a great number of women running campaigns right now, they encountered all the same problems coming up in terms of, I mean, politics is a boys' club, and that it always has been. These women are trying to change that now.
You also address the shine theory in your piece. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, the shine theory was coined by a woman named Ann Friedman, and I can't remember the other woman she was working with, but the idea is that if you surround yourself with successful women, you yourself will be more successful. You will build off of each other. You'll support each other. And that was definitely something I heard from, I mean, these women running these Democratic campaigns right now in the governor's race are competing with each other, but they're also so happy to be competing with each other instead of some of the same male faces that they've seen along the way. And so they're supportive of their competitors in these roles.
As we start to wrap up here, what did you learn about future hopes, future ambitions for campaign staff once the election is over?
I mean, the hope is, what we talked about this year is this field is larger than fields before in terms of the gubernatorial race. And so there are maybe more positions and maybe some candidates thought outside the box a little bit. The hope among the women who are running these races is that they will continue to have that that foothold, you know, now that they've gotten into to management positions and to running these campaigns, that, you know, people will continue to think of them for these positions. And the way that that happens is by lifting each other up and by thinking of each other. You know, you once you've worked with someone on a campaign, you think, oh, you know what, that worked out really well. I'm going to call on that person again. So every single woman that I talked to, it was a priority to say, you know, I'm here and I'm so glad that I'm here, but I'm going to bring other women up along the way.
Well, Jesse, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jesse Apoyan covers state government and politics for the Capital Times. She's been writing about the female makeup of campaign staffers. Coming up, we'll step back and look at the nationwide trend with analysis out of Rutgers University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a woman who is running for office this year? What reservations did you have? How did you move past them? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Back after this news. We're looking at what's behind this record number of women running for office here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A blizzard that hit Washington, D.C. in 2016 shut down business across the district, but some congressional leaders, they showed up for work. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski is a Republican from Alaska. She pointed out the people who came to work were women.
The presiding officer is female. All of our parliamentarians are female. Our floor managers are female. All of our pages are female. Now, this was not orchestrated in any way, shape, or form. We came in this morning, looked around, and thought something is different this morning. Different in a good way, I might add.
Murkowski suggested that that spoke to the hardiness of a woman. She puts on her boots, pulls on her hat, trudges through the mess to get to work. Let's bring in Kelly Dittmar. She is an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University, Camden. She's also a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. She's author of the book Navigating Gendered Terrain, Stereotypes and Strategy in Political Campaigns. Kelly, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're hearing about 2018 as a record year for women in politics. Delve into the numbers for us. What milestones have we hit?
Sure. So we've already surpassed the record number of women running for the U.S. House nationally. We're about at 324 women candidates. Our previous record for filed candidates was 298, and we set that in 2012. So we're already seeing an increase there, and we have a number of states left to file, about 20 states left to file. So we expect that we'll see just a continued increase in that record. We also have surpassed the record for women running for governor this year, and that number is particularly high as well. We expect that, you know, we could surpass that record of 34. We could get close to double that. We'll see if some of the women who've said they're running drop out or not. And we are getting close to surpassing the record for women running for the U.S. Senate, but we're not quite there yet. What we're seeing this year, though, in terms of those numbers, is that much of the increase in women running this year is happening on the Democratic side of the aisle. So to take into some context those numbers, where we're seeing the greatest increase is among Democratic women.
Well, let's pause there on Senate. We now have a record number of women in the U.S. Senate. Mississippi's Sure. new U.S. senator brings the total number of women in the Senate to 23. Does the Senate number push the whole Congress then to a record as well?
Unfortunately, no, because it brought us up one, but we had just lost one woman in Congress within the last month as well, because Representative Louise Slaughter had passed away. So we're kind of back up to where we were, which is 83 women in the House, 23 women in the Senate, just at 19.8% of all of the U.S. Congress, which is where we had been before. So what we'll be looking ahead to is there's an Arizona special election coming up for the U.S. House, where there's a guaranteed woman winning. So we will see a slight increase in the members of the U.S. Congress, women members, in the next month, I believe.
But it seems like the Senate has been a tough nut to crack, Kelly. I mean, it's just really low. What is it about the Senate?
Well, I mean, the percentage, I will say the percentage of women in the Senate is higher than the percentage of women in the U.S. House right now. But across the U.S. Congress, it has been a challenge to see significant increases. If you look sort of historically, a lot of people will point back to 1992, the year of the woman. And we call it that because the number of women in Congress nearly doubled in that election year. Now, we were still a low percentage, about 10% overall. But we did see that increase that was, you know, swift. We haven't seen that since then. So the progress for women in the U.S. Congress, and quite frankly, at all levels of office in the United States, has been very slow and incremental. And that speaks to a number of challenges and barriers that women face in running for office, many of which are structural. Do they have the support infrastructure? Are they being recruited? Are parties promoting the inclusion of women, or are they not seeking out women to run for office and support them once they decide to do that? And then there's some questions about women's decision to run. So we have done some research at the Center for American Women in Politics that shows that women make the decision to run differently than men, and that leads to lower candidate numbers.
In what way? In what way do they make a decision that's different than men?
There are a couple of things. One is when we did a survey of state legislators, and this was men and women at the state legislative level across the United States, we asked them what was their primary reason for running for office. And for women, it was because they had a particular public policy issue that they cared about and that they wanted to see change on in office. For men, when we asked the top issue, the number one issue that motivated them to run for office, it was because they had a longstanding desire to be an elected official. Our shorthand for that is women run for office to do something, men run for office to be somebody. And we sort of joke about that, but it matters because if you look at government and politics right now, and you don't see it as a place to get things done, that's going to diminish the number of women who are willing to run in the first place. And then the second reason, a second sort of big finding from that survey and other research on women running for office is that they are more likely to question their qualifications and more likely to consider a number of other factors other than their own desire to run in their decision to run for office. So how will it affect my family? How might it affect my community organization that I'm a part of? And we talk about that as relationally embedded decision making, whereas men are more likely to wake up, say they want to run and go ahead and do it because that's something they have wanted or decide they want to do.
Kelly Dittmar is with us. She's an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University, Camden. She's also a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics. We're looking at the makeup of women in state and federal offices across the country running for office. You can join in the conversation. Do you find yourself thinking about female candidates differently than male politicians? Have you found yourself wondering whether a woman can be a mom and serve constituents? Do you have concerns about fatherhood? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Kelly, do you know, are there some delegations out there that are only men that represent some states, or are women part of every congressional delegation?
Unfortunately, there are all male delegations today, and I think sometimes we forget that. You mentioned earlier that we had added the first woman to the Mississippi delegation ever. So Cindy Hyde Smith is the first woman to represent Mississippi in Congress. If you recall, it's been 101 years since we had the first woman in Congress, so it took them quite a while. Vermont is still the only state now that has never sent a woman to Congress, but there are 11 states that currently don't have women representing them. My home state of Pennsylvania has no women in Congress today. And if you sort of expand this a little more broadly, 33 states don't have a woman of color representing them. So there's still a lot of work to be done, a lot of progress to be made for women in Congress and across levels of office.
At this point, have all states sent women to Congress, or have some voters always chosen men to go to Washington?
Yeah, so we have one more state, one state that has never sent a woman to Congress ever, and that's Vermont. And people are often surprised by that because there's pretty significant representation of women at the state legislative level, and it's seen as a more progressive state. But they have yet to send a woman to Congress.
And about one in five members of Congress is a woman. Before you get to D.C., you have to run a successful campaign. What do we know about how women run their campaigns as they are running for office?
So, you know, there's a real diversity and there's no set of rules. Sometimes we talk about, like, how do you run as a woman? And there's no uniform pattern for that. At the same point, there are some consistent or persistent challenges for women that are distinct from men. And you mentioned a couple of them. Are they asked questions that their male counterparts are not asked? Often with young children, that has been a challenge. I do think what we're seeing in the last couple of cycles, and you're seeing it in Wisconsin this cycle, is women using their roles as mothers as an asset to their candidacy instead of something that they have to answer for or overcome. Saying that, you know, being a mother brings them particular experience and expertise to run for office. I think that's a positive thing, but it has been something that women have navigated differently than men. Women have also navigated other gender biases around how they look, how they speak in ways that men have not. Because as a country, we're still getting used to the idea of women in high levels of political leadership. You know, we can all think about Hillary Clinton or Nancy Pelosi or in your state, Tammy Baldwin, but there's still a dearth of women at those high levels of leadership, whereas we've been accustomed to seeing men, and particularly white men, in those roles for a long time. So some of those things have made a difference in how women have to think about their campaign. And sometimes it's on a very sort of surface level about what they wear and how they behave. And then sometimes it's about the issues and how they connect with voters. And I think that whereas in the past, women have had to sort of adapt to fit a masculine norm, you know, prove you're strong, you're tough, you meet these masculine credentials, we're starting to see some shift, at least, in women being able to be sort of more authentically themselves and bring some different credentials to the table.
Well, you talk Pelosi, Clinton, Baldwin. What about women who have made it? They decided to run. They finished a campaign, won the election. They've served in Congress. And then what happens? Do they run for re-election? Do they serve multiple terms? What does your data show?
Yeah, it's interesting. We don't often actually at the center cut the data this way, but some of my colleagues have looked into these questions about sort of progressive ambition. Do you see women increasing up the ladder in terms of politics? And it's still a sort of relatively small literature. So we know that women are advancing. We can see the women in state legislative leadership and in leadership at Congress. We see women sort of running for Congress and governor. But our impression is that that's still a smaller proportion, at least, or a smaller number than men, in part because we're just starting with a smaller pool. And that the decisions to run for higher office, again, are going to be slightly different for women because, as I mentioned earlier, they might be making some different considerations. They're running for higher office, but it's just taking a longer time because we're starting with fewer of them. And they are confronting still, as they are running for the first time, some of the same biases and barriers, particularly in that case, partisan networks and political networks that are still dominated by men. So when, you know, a gubernatorial seat comes up or a Senate seat comes up, are they looking to women? Are the men sort of who might be highly influential in deciding who's going to be tapped for that higher level office? Who are they? Are men at the table, and are they considering women as really viable and necessary candidates for those higher positions?
Let's look at the governor's races. What do we know about women who are running for governor at this time? Because the climate of what these women are running in can vary quite significantly state to state, right?
Yeah, it's really important. And as I was mentioning earlier, and thinking about general ways in which women are running, it really matters the context in which they are running. And one of the different contexts that we always point to in our research is just the difference between legislative and executive office. Mm. Executive office in the United States in particular has been one of the most masculine offices. And what I mean by that is that voters' associations with the traits and the areas of expertise that they desire in office holders for governor and for president have been more likely to align with stereotypes associated with men and masculinity. And so for women to run for governor in particular has presented some unique challenges. To be that sole leader has been something that we found in some research voters are a little less comfortable with than they are with choosing a woman to be part of a group, to be part of a team of legislators in a state legislature or in Congress. And so that means that choosing and deciding how you run for that office is going to be a little bit different. And then the other context I think that you've noted is also state by state. So the dynamics that are happening in the Wisconsin gubernatorial race are going to be significantly different than what's happening in California. And so these women are really trying to navigate statewide contexts that they may not have before, because many of them either haven't run before or have run for a legislative district office that is only representing part of a state.
Kelly Dittmar, what about being first? Many women candidates running have potential to be the first woman elected to their particular office. What are the advantages to being first, and what are some disadvantages?
Yeah. So I'll start with the more, the disadvantages. And one is just, again, thinking about what voters are accustomed to. When voters go to the polls, we hope that they know all about the candidates and they've done all their research. But we know in reality that many times they're using cues. They're using something that they know about the candidate to make assumptions about the rest of what the candidate believes and how well they're going to do. And so sometimes they are going to use gender as a cue to indicate maybe what the candidate cares about or what they believe. So in that way, gender can work as an advantage or a disadvantage. But to my point earlier about the stereotypes and expectations we might have for our executive office, in that way, gender can often work as something that might lead to voter doubts that a woman can do the job. On the advantage side, though, especially in a context where gendered issues like sexual harassment or just the general inequality of power between men and women in society today, raised by things like Me Too or the Women's March, might cue voters to think more seriously about the importance of having a gender diversity in office and having more women in office. So in that way, maybe it's an advantage. And maybe it's an advantage if candidates think in unique and different ways about how they talk about gender in a way that is advantageous.
The 2018 midterm elections are historic when it comes to the sheer number of women candidates who are running. Record 309 women had filed paperwork to run for seats in the U.S. House. 29 are running for the Senate. We're looking at the trends over time with Kelly Dittmar. She's an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University Camden. She's also a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you talked yourself out of running for office? What held you back? Are there challenges that men have too, or did you make the decision based on issues unique to women? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings, back after this news on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a record number of women running for political office and what forces are at work, what the data show over time. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last week, Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois became the first U.S. senator to give birth while holding office. She talked about the challenges of taking maternity leave while representing her state in Congress. Since the birth of her first child, she has introduced several bills focused on families, but none has been voted into law.
The more women we get into office, the more family-friendly legislation we're going to have, and the more we are going to get an understanding of the connection between family-friendly legislation and economic well-being for our nation. We need family leave, not because it's the warm and fuzzy and nice thing to do, but because it's better for our economy.
Kelly Dittmar stays with us. She is an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University Camden, also a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics, author of the book Navigating Gendered Terrain. You can join in with your stories, your insights, 800-642-1234. Are you a woman who's won a political race? Did you find a smooth transition into office? Or did you discover your service was more difficult because of your obligation as a woman? Call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Paul from Eau Claire has emailed. He says, I view it as automatic disqualification when a woman claims her gender as a qualification to run for office. Kelly, can you look into that a little bit? Since when is gender a qualification for office?
Yeah, so I think that that's really interesting because gender has clearly been a qualification used for office for the men who have dominated office holding for the last 100+ years. We just haven't thought about it that way. But if you think about why we don't have so many women and the presumptions of qualifications to men, it's largely rooted in gender-based assumptions. I would say in terms of thinking of gender as a credential for office, it's not about the sort of sex, right? You check off you're a male or female, and therefore you're qualified to run for office. But you have to believe that there is a different experience that men and women have in living their lives in the United States, in Wisconsin, in their communities. And if you believe that there are still gender differences in those experiences, including the experience that Tammy Duckworth is talking about having a child and being a primary caregiver, something that is much more common among women, you then have to look at how that perspective will add value to policy making and decision making. And that is where gender can be a credential for office, because you bring a distinct perspective, you bring a distinct experience, and it's not universal among all women. But in fact, what we want is a diversity of women as well to bring those different perspectives to the debate.
Let's go way back to 1973. Pat Schroeder entered Congress. She wound up spending 24 years representing Colorado. Early on, her rivals called her Little Patsy. Do voters have trouble taking women seriously?
I think that has definitely been a challenge historically. Thankfully, we are seeing changes in voter perceptions of gender. That has to do in large part with changes in our culture about valuing women and thinking about women in positions of power. But despite those advances, it doesn't mean that we still don't see particularly gendered attacks on women. So it may be that because they don't already agree with a woman on policy, right, they find ways to make those sorts of quips about her that are particularly rooted in her being a woman. And so this is something that women still experience on the campaign trail once they're in office. And particularly now with the proliferation of attacks on social media, it makes it easier for people to make those sorts of attacks without letting their name be known, right? They can do it behind the veil of social media, even if it's not seen as socially acceptable today.
And Schroeder had two young children at the beginning of her congressional career. Here she is talking about the resistance she received from colleagues who didn't think she could balance her obligations.
The question was asked, how can you be a mother and a congresswoman? I said, I have a brain, I have a uterus, and they both work.
That's a pretty famous quote. Now, how should we think of motherhood as women work to be effective leaders? And you mentioned U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth working on this as well, about how, you know, whether she would be allowed to breastfeed while sitting in session.
Yeah. So I want to say that, you know, unfortunately, we still see those same sorts of questions. We did a report last year interviewing 83 of the women in Congress and asked them about the importance of their representation and their experiences as women. And Representative Grace Meng, who's a young woman representative from New York, talked about being asked or criticized for bringing her children to campaign events or constituent events, being told they didn't elect her to be a babysitter. So these things still happen, and it's something that women confront. But I do think, as I mentioned before, the progress is thinking about ways now that women talk about motherhood and talk openly about their motherhood as something that gives them a perspective and a passion and a motivation to make policy change that will be good for their children and for the next generation. So Tammy Duckworth is talking about being a mother and understanding what it's like to need family-friendly policies. That caregiving responsibility is something that many of the women we spoke to said brought them together across party lines, something that was unique to women that influenced the policies that they thought were important. And that's just one example. Other women talk about motherhood as a reason to promote economic policies that are going to be better for the future, to cut wasteful spending. If you're on the Republican side of the aisle, a message that is often used by women and sometimes used by women in the context of being a mother. So there are many ways in which you can think about motherhood beyond just a challenge and something that might hold you back from office, but instead something that brings a unique perspective for women in policymaking.
Do you think that we need adjustments in Congress if we expect women to serve? Because Duckworth here, trying to be able to nurse while sitting in session, she asked what she's supposed to do with her daughter. If a vote's happening, she needs to vote and she's feeding the baby.
Yeah. Well, this is a really great reminder about how political institutions, particularly Congress, but also our state legislatures, have been built for and by men, literally without women in mind. I mean, we could do a story on every state legislature across the country, as well as Congress, about the availability of a woman's bathroom near the floor. I mean, these are recent additions. In 2013, women built Nancy Pelosi was responsible for building a women's bathroom near the House floor so that women didn't have to use the same bathroom as the tourists. So yes, institutions need to change. They literally need to change in how they're built and structured, and also in the rules that have governed them for so long. But I do think it's going to be difficult. This is something that the U.S. Congress and state legislatures haven't really dealt with here in the U.S., but they may look to some governments across the world that have tried to move forward on family-friendly policies, whether it be in the schedules that they adopt, or to your point about permissions, about breastfeeding on the floor, providing daycare near to the institution. So these are all things that I do think need to be looked into, but I'm not naive enough to think this won't be a difficult transition for many of our governmental institutions.
Do you, women who are running for office, do they have to meet some sort of masculine credentials to succeed?
Yeah, that is what we have seen historically. If you look at sort of political psychology literature that looks at what we value in our leaders, in particular our political leaders, versus what we expect about women, sort of our gender stereotypes, those two sets of stereotypes are often in opposition, or at least not complementary to each other. Whereas for men, the expectations of men and masculinity and the expectations of office holders often align. These do change and evolve over time. So I think now voters see a broader swath of qualifications that might be necessary for office holding. But we have seen women really try to prove things like being tough and strong and assertive, things and traits that are often associated with men, as well as expertise associated more often with men. Things like being good on economic issues and national security defense issues, that those seem to be things voters have cared most about. What we hope to see, or what I guess hope to see, is a shift in how women and men campaign so that they talk about a wider variety of credentials, both on traits and issues, so that it isn't a rule that women have to meet masculine credentials, but instead can present a different model or a different image of what it looks like and what it means to be a candidate or elected official.
Kelly, is winning a race the only sign of success for a woman candidate, or can simply running change voters' expectations for the future, the act of running?
Yeah, I think this year this is a really important thing to think about. We have a lot of women running, but a lot of them are running in steep sort of uphill climbs. It's going to be hard for the surge of women running this year to win because they're running as challengers. They're often running against other women in primaries. And so we should sort of be careful to think about what's going to happen in November. But I would argue, even if we don't see a doubling of the women in Congress, which I don't believe we'll see this year, the fact that these women are running and that they're running with voices and images that are different than we've seen historically, that you're breastfeeding in a campaign ad, that you're talking about your Me Too experiences, that you're talking about the value of having women at the table, that pushes voters, I believe, to think differently about what they value in our candidates and our office holders, and hopefully makes it a little bit easier for women and men running in the future who don't want to just align with the model of candidacy and office holding that we've had for so long.
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Kelly Dittmar is an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University Camden. She's also a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. She's author of the book Navigating Gendered Terrain, Stereotypes and Strategy in Political Campaigns. Earlier, we talked with Capital Times state government reporter Jesse O'Poyan about women running campaigns for Wisconsin candidates. This hour of the morning show was produced by Brianne Shasso and Keely Boltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. Cheryl Gasser is director of the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network.